Good morning and welcome to the Wednesday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. How North Korea's ICBM test could bring negotiators back to the table, by Charlie Campbell in Beijing. During his New Year's speech, Kim Jong-un declared that North Korea had entered the final stage of preparation for the test launch of an intercontinental ballistic missile, ICBM, adding that it would provide a powerful military guarantee for defending the destiny of the nation. Like his father before him, the 33-year-old dictator evidently believes that a nuclear-armed ICBM safeguards him from the sort of Western-backed regime change that toppled Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein and Libyan despot Muammar Gaddafi. On Tuesday, Kim presided over the firing of an ICBM that soared at an altitude of 1,731 miles for 580 miles before crashing into the Sea of Japan. Experts posit that such a rocket, which Pyongyang calls a Hwasong-14, could potentially travel 4,100 miles, technical wrinkles notwithstanding. That puts Alaska within striking range. Afterward, North Korean state television boasted that the regime had, in an instant, become a full-fledged nuclear power that possesses a powerful intercontinental ballistic rocket capable of hitting any part of the world. North Korea's official news agency KCNA quoted Kim as saying that the July 4th launch formed a package of gifts to the Yankees on their Independence Day. In a statement conceding that the launch was indeed of an ICBM, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson condemned a new escalation of the threat to the United States, our allies and partners, the region, and the world. According to IHS Jane's analyst Carl Dewey, the launch has bought Kim time, giving decision-makers in Washington reason to pause for thought before deciding to strike the communist regime. Self-reliance is always a core part of North Korea ideology, and Kim Jong-un uses that language as well, says John DeLury, an East Asia expert at South Korea's Yonsei University. To some extent, it's psychological, as Kim Jong-un wants to feel safe and secure. The launch also shows that U.S. President Donald Trump's bluster has had no effect. After Kim made his New Year pronouncement about testing an ICBM, Trump tweeted, "It won't happen." Then in April, Trump dispatched the Carl Vinson U.S. Navy strike group to the Korean Peninsula in a show of force, warning of a major conflict if North Korea didn't denuclearize. Kim kept on testing missiles. After Tuesday's successful launch, Trump was reduced to musing, "Does this guy have anything better to do with his life?" He then added, "Perhaps China will put a heavy move on North Korea and end this nonsense once and for all." There has been a tightening of UN sanctions enforcement at the 880-mile shared border that China shares with North Korea. When G20 leaders meet in Hamburg on Friday, it's also likely that Chinese President Xi Jinping will be encouraged to squeeze further. But Beijing will never foment the collapse of the regime. It is unwilling to deal with the resulting flood of famished refugees that will pour over the border in the event of Kim's demise. More importantly, it has no wish to see a U.S.-allied unified Korean peninsula ruled from Seoul, potentially bringing American troops right up to its doorstep. China is not going to support an economic maritime blockade at the UN Security Council, says Daniel Pinkston, a political scientist at South Korea's Troy University, and China is not going to block the border. Military options remain a last resort for myriad reasons. U.S. allies South Korea and Japan, which together host more than 60,000 American troops as well as many thousands more expatriate U.S. citizens, are within range of Pyongyang's conventional and nuclear arsenals. And there's no guarantee that a preemptive strike could knock out Kim's weapons completely. Military action just isn't feasible. That's the bottom line, says DeLury. It just doesn't pass any cost-benefit analysis. The last option is to negotiate. In his statement Tuesday, Tillerson reaffirmed, "We will never accept a nuclear-armed North Korea." But the facts may have surpassed his resolve. There are also signs that something may have shaken loose on the Pyongyang side. On Tuesday, KCNA also quoted Kim directly as saying that North Korea would never consider putting its nukes up for negotiations unless U.S. hostile policy and nuclear threat to North Korea are definitely terminated. Dulury spies a possible veiled offer in that statement, calling it one of the strongest signals directly of Kim Jong-un saying that he will discuss denuclearization. But Pinkston warns that caving in to North Korean demands validates their whole project and program and activities. He says it's nerve-wracking, but the rest of the world should make them feel less and not more secure. Indeed, engaging with a regime that, according to a 2014 UN report, inflicts crimes against humanity on its 25 million citizens is a quandary, as is what the international community is willing to put on the table. On Tuesday, Moscow and Beijing jointly backed a double freeze. North Korea freezes its missile and nuclear program in exchange for a freeze in large-scale U.S.-South Korea military exercises, which Pyongyang regards as a dress rehearsal for invasion. A double freeze would be the most obvious first step for negotiations, says William Chung, Shangri-La Dialogue Senior Fellow for Asia-Pacific Security at Singapore's International Institute for Strategic Studies. Dulury is optimistic regarding the successful ICBM test launch as a pivot point from Kim's perspective. They have a new level of security they feel with the deterrence capability, he says, so they may be willing to negotiate certain compromises. More Americans trust CNN than Donald Trump, poll finds, by Lisa Marie Segarra. While Donald Trump has recently bashed CNN on Twitter, a new poll has found that more Americans actually trust the network more than the president. Overall, 50% of adults said they trust CNN more than Trump, compared to 43% of adults who said they trust the president more than CNN, according to a poll from SurveyMonkey. Whether people trust CNN or Trump more varied largely along party lines. Of Republicans, 89% said they trusted Trump more, and 9% said they trusted CNN more. Among Democrats, only 5% said they trust Trump more compared to the 91% who said they trusted CNN more. Independents were split, with 40% saying they trust Trump more and 55% saying they trust CNN more. The survey found that adults also trusted the New York Times, Washington Post, and network news programs like NBC, CBS, and ABC more than the president. The online poll surveyed 4,965 adults from June 29th to July 3rd and has a margin of error of plus or minus 2.5 points. No specific agenda, but Trump and Putin have lots to discuss. By Josh Lederman and Matthew Lee for the Associated Press in Washington. President Donald Trump's first face-to-face meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin this week will be brimming with global intrigue, but the White House says there's no specific agenda. So, in the absence of a set list of topics, what are two of the world's most famously unpredictable leaders to discuss? Trump, who prefers to have neatly packaged achievements to pair with high-profile meetings, may be looking for some concessions from Russia to show he's delivering progress and helping restore a productive relationship between the two powers. Putin would almost surely want something in return, and there's a long list of irritants between the two countries that they could potentially resolve. Ahead of the meeting, White House National Security Council and State Department officials have been reviewing possible gestures the U.S. could offer Russia as part of the meeting, a current and a former administration official said. They weren't authorized to comment publicly and requested anonymity. Yet any outward sign of bonhomie between Trump and Putin would be immediately seized upon by the president's critics and Russia hawks eager to show he's cozying up to the Russian leader. the ongoing investigations into Russia's interference in the U.S. election and potential Trump campaign collusion won't be far from anyone's minds. The two leaders will sit down in Hamburg, Germany, on the sidelines of a Group of 20 summit. Ahead of the meeting, Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak met Monday in Washington with the number 3 U.S. diplomat Thomas Shannon to prepare. A look at what Trump and Putin could address. Election hacking. Trump has been reluctant to publicly and directly acknowledge Russia's role in meddling in the U.S. election. Out of apparent concern, it undermines the legitimacy of his win. He's also insisted there was no collusion with him or his campaign, a conclusion that U.S. investigators have not yet reached. U.S. officials say Russia tried to hack election systems in 21 states and to sway the election for Trump, a level of interference in the U.S. political system that security experts say represents a top-level threat that should command a forceful response from the U.S. Putin has denied all this. There are no indications Trump plans to raise Russia's meddling at the meeting. Yet if he doesn't, it will give fuel to Trump's critics who say he's blatantly ignoring a major national security threat. It could also embolden those who say Trump is trying to cover up for the Russians after benefiting from their interference. Irritants. Each side has a long list of complaints about the other that do not rise to the geopolitical level, but are nonetheless impeding broader attempts to coordinate or cooperate on larger concerns. After meeting in Moscow earlier this year, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov agreed to set up a mechanism to deal with these issues the Russians describe as irritants and the Americans call the smalls. But even that effort has stalled. After the Treasury last month imposed new sanctions on Russia for its intervention in Ukraine, Moscow called off a scheduled second meeting between Thomas Shannon, the U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, and Sergei Ryabkov, a Russian deputy foreign minister. Shannon and Ryabkov's canceled June 23rd meeting in St. Petersburg has yet to be rescheduled. It was not clear if either Trump or Putin would seek to reopen the channel when they see each other in Hamburg, although Tillerson and other State Department officials have taken pains to stress that they remain open to a resumption of the talks. Russia's wish list. Russia has been especially vocal about its chief demand, the return of two properties it owns in the U.S. that were seized by the Obama administration as punishment for Russian meddling in the 2016 election. The recreational compounds are located in Oyster Bay, New York, on Long Island, and along the Corsica River in the Eastern Shore region of Maryland. On Monday, Putin's foreign affairs advisor, Yuri Ushakov, said Russia had been remarkably restrained by declining to retaliate, but that its patience was running out. If the U.S. doesn't soon give back the compounds, also known as DACAs, Moscow will have no choice but to retaliate, Ushakov said. Another Russian demand is to ease surveillance of its diplomats in the U.S. U.S. demands. The U.S. has its own list, topped by a resumption of adoptions of Russian children by American parents, which Russia banned in late 2012, an end to what it says is intensifying harassment of U.S. diplomats and other officials in Russia, and a resolution to a dispute over a piece of land in St. Petersburg that was meant to be the site of a new U.S. consulate in Russia's second-largest city. The U.S. also wants expanded cultural and exchange programs between the two countries. Such programs were vastly curtailed or ended after Putin's 2012 return to the Kremlin in an election he accused Washington of interfering in. Tillerson has made the adoption issue a priority, according to aides, although it remains unclear if he has succeeded in convincing the Russians to even consider revisiting the ban. The property dispute in St. Petersburg dates to 2014, when Russia blocked the U.S. from developing the site after the Obama administration hit Russia with sanctions because of its annexation of Ukraine's Crimea region. Officials say the U.S. won't simply swap the Russian compounds for the St. Petersburg consulate. Action on the other demands is also required, they say. Ukraine sanctions. Moscow has long sought an easing of economic sanctions the U.S. slapped on Russia over its actions in eastern Ukraine and annexation of Crimea, which the U.S. does not recognize, though there were indications that Trump's aides entertained easing the sanctions in the run-up to the inauguration and early days of his presidency, his administration has repeatedly insisted that they will stay in place until Russia pulls out of Crimea and lives up to its commitments under a ceasefire deal for eastern Ukraine that has never been fully implemented. Given that Russia has taken neither of those steps, easing sanctions would require a major reversal by Trump and would infuriate Russia hawks in both parties in the U.S. In fact, Congress has been pushing to increase sanctions on Russia and make them harder for Trump to lift. The Senate has passed the popular measure, which won't go to a House vote before Trump's meeting with Putin. Syria. Eager to bolster his global legitimacy, Putin has been pressing the U.S. to cooperate militarily with Russia in Syria, where both Moscow and Washington oppose the Islamic State group but disagree about Syrian President Bashar Assad. Though defense laws passed in the wake of the Ukraine crisis bar the U.S. military from cooperating with Russia, the two have maintained a deconfliction hotline to ensure their forces don't accidentally collide on the crowded Syrian battlefield. The Pentagon has steadfastly resisted proposals to work closely with Russia in Syria. Out of concern, the U.S. can't trust Moscow with sensitive intelligence information. But the problems posed by the lack of coordination in Syria have resurfaced following recent events. The U.S. has recently shot down several pro-Syrian government aircraft, leading Russia, an ally of the Syrian government, to threaten to shoot down any aircraft that flies west of the Euphrates River. No specific agenda, but Trump and Putin have lots to discuss. By Josh Lederman and Matthew Lee for the Associated Press in Washington. President Donald Trump's first face-to-face meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin this week will be brimming with global intrigue, but the White House says there's no specific agenda. So, in the absence of a set list of topics, what are two of the world's most famously unpredictable leaders to discuss? Trump, who prefers to have neatly packaged achievements to pair with high-profile meetings, may be looking for some concessions from Russia to show he's delivering progress and helping restore a productive relationship between the two powers. Putin would almost surely want something in return, and there's a long list of irritants between the two countries that they could potentially resolve. Ahead of the meeting, White House National Security Council and State Department officials have been reviewing possible gestures the U.S. could offer Russia as part of the meeting, a current and a former administration official said. They weren't authorized to comment publicly and requested anonymity. Yet any outward sign of bonhomie between Trump and Putin would be immediately seized upon by the president's critics and Russia hawks eager to show he's cozying up to the Russian leader. The ongoing investigations into Russia's interference in the U.S. election and potential Trump campaign collusion won't be far from anyone's minds. The two leaders will sit down in Hamburg, Germany, on the sidelines of a Group of 20 summit. Ahead of the meeting, Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak met Monday in Washington with the number 3 U.S. diplomat Thomas Shannon to prepare. A look at what Trump and Putin could address. Election hacking. Trump has been reluctant to publicly and directly acknowledge Russia's role in meddling in the U.S. election, out of apparent concern it undermines the legitimacy of his win. He's also insisted there was no collusion with him or his campaign, a conclusion that U.S. investigators have not yet reached. U.S. officials say Russia tried to hack election systems in 21 states and to sway the election for Trump, a level of interference in the U.S. political system that security experts say represents a top-level threat that should command a forceful response from the U.S. Putin has denied all this. there are no indications Trump plans to raise Russia's meddling at the meeting. Yet if he doesn't, it will give fuel to Trump's critics who say he's blatantly ignoring a major national security threat. It could also embolden those who say Trump is trying to cover up for the Russians after benefiting from their interference. Irritants. Each side has a long list of complaints about the other that do not rise to the geopolitical level, but are nonetheless impeding broader attempts to coordinate or cooperate on larger concerns. After meeting in Moscow earlier this year, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov agreed to set up a mechanism to deal with these issues the Russians describe as irritants and the Americans call the smalls. But even that effort has stalled. After the Treasury last month imposed new sanctions on Russia for its intervention in Ukraine, Moscow called off a scheduled second meeting between Thomas Shannon, the U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, and Sergei Ryabkov, a Russian deputy foreign minister. Shannon and Ryabkov's canceled June 23rd meeting in St. Petersburg has yet to be rescheduled. It was not clear if either Trump or Putin would seek to reopen the channel when they see each other in Hamburg, although Tillerson and other State Department officials have taken pains to stress that they remain open to a resumption of the talks. Russia's wish list. Russia has been especially vocal about its chief demand, the return of two properties it owns in the U.S. that were seized by the Obama administration as punishment for Russian meddling in the 2016 election. The recreational compounds are located in Oyster Bay, New York, on Long Island, and along the Corsica River in the Eastern Shore region of Maryland. On Monday, Putin's foreign affairs advisor, Yuri Ushakov, said Russia had been remarkably restrained by declining to retaliate, but that its patience was running out. If the U.S. doesn't soon give back the compounds, also known as Dakas, Moscow will have no choice but to retaliate, Ushakov said. Another Russian demand is to ease surveillance of its diplomats in the U.S. U.S. demands. The U.S. has its own list, topped by a resumption of adoptions of Russian children by American parents, which Russia banned in late 2012, an end to what it says is intensifying harassment of U.S. diplomats and other officials in Russia, and a resolution to a dispute over a piece of land in St. Petersburg that was meant to be the site of a new U.S. consulate in Russia's second-largest city. The U.S. also wants expanded cultural and exchange programs between the two countries. Such programs were vastly curtailed or ended after Putin's 2012 return to the Kremlin in an election he accused Washington of interfering in. Tillerson has made the adoption issue a priority, according to aides, although it remains unclear if he has succeeded in convincing the Russians to even consider revisiting the ban. The property dispute in St. Petersburg dates to 2014, when Russia blocked the U.S. from developing the site after the Obama administration hit Russia with sanctions because of its annexation of Ukraine's Crimea region. Officials say the U.S. won't simply swap the Russian compounds for the St. Petersburg consulate. Action on the other demands is also required, they say. Ukraine sanctions. Moscow has long sought an easing of economic sanctions the U.S. slapped on Russia over its actions in eastern Ukraine and annexation of Crimea, which the U.S. does not recognize. Though there were indications that Trump's aides entertained easing the sanctions in the run-up to the inauguration and early days of his presidency, his administration has repeatedly insisted that they will stay in place until Russia pulls out of Crimea and lives up to its commitments under a ceasefire deal for eastern Ukraine that has never been fully implemented. Given that Russia has taken neither of those steps, easing sanctions would require a major reversal by Trump and would infuriate Russia hawks in both parties in the U.S. In fact, Congress has been pushing to increase sanctions on Russia and make them harder for Trump to lift. The Senate has passed the popular measure, which won't go to a House vote before Trump's meeting with Putin. Syria. Eager to bolster his global legitimacy, Putin has been pressing the U.S. to cooperate militarily with Russia in Syria, where both Moscow and Washington oppose the Islamic State group but disagree about Syrian President Bashar Assad. Though defense laws passed in the wake of the Ukraine crisis bar the U.S. military from cooperating with Russia, the two have maintained a deconfliction hotline to ensure their forces don't accidentally collide on the crowded Syrian battlefield. The Pentagon has steadfastly resisted proposals to work closely with Russia in Syria, out of concern the U.S. can't trust Moscow with sensitive intelligence information. But the problems posed by the lack of coordination in Syria have resurfaced following recent events. The U.S. has recently shot down several pro-Syrian government aircraft, leading Russia, an ally of the Syrian government, to threaten to shoot down any aircraft that flies west of the Euphrates River.
See how Cersei Lannister has changed over 6 seasons of Game of Thrones by Megan McCluskey. Cersei Lannister's costumes in Game of Thrones have consistently mirrored her story's arc. When viewers meet Cersei in the first episode, she had just reluctantly made the journey from King's Landing to Winterfell with her now late husband, King Robert Baratheon. At the time, she was playing the part of dutiful wife. However, her choice of clothing in House Lannister's colors of red and gold hinted at what relationships were truly important to her. After successfully plotting the death of Robert and ensuring the ascension of Joffrey, her oldest son, with her twin brother Jaime, to the Iron Throne, she adopted even more regal outfits that signified her growing power. Cersei's most recent ensemble, the militant black gown she wore to be crowned as Queen of the Seven Kingdoms in the Season 6 finale, demonstrated her ruthlessness in the wake of the death of her last surviving child. Black was the obvious choice, costume designer Michelle Clapton told Vanity Fair. Yes, it is for mourning her children, her father, but it's more than that. To me, it represents a deadness inside her, the overwhelming desire for power at any cost. The multi-layered effect created by mounting the leather onto the silver brocade gives a more complex feeling, implying that nothing achieved is ever simple.
Does pink Himalayan salt have any health benefits? By Alexandra Sifferlin. Pink salt is everywhere, in salt grinders, craggy-looking lamps, sunset-hued slabs designed for cooking steak, and even in salt rooms at spas. But is pink Himalayan salt worth all the attention? We checked out the science behind this recent health phenomenon. The Thing. Pink Himalayan salt is made from rock crystals of salt that have been mined from areas close to the Himalayas, often in Pakistan. It gets its rosy hue from trace minerals in the salt, like magnesium, potassium, and calcium. Pink salt is often found as smaller crystals in salt grinders, as large glowing pink or orange chunks in pink Himalayan salt lamps, and in the walls of salt chambers at spas that promise an instant detox. The hype. People claim the salt does all kinds of things. It's rumored to be healthier for its greater concentration of trace elements. In lamp form, companies claim that it eases symptoms of seasonal affective disorder, SAD, or SAD, increases energy and improves sleep by cleansing the air from pollutants like dust and pollen. It supposedly does this by absorbing water molecules from the air and releasing negative air ions, which are said to get rid of particles like dust that can cause respiratory problems, like allergies and asthma, and affect mood. Spas have also jumped on these claims to offer Himalayan salt-based therapies, where people sit in rooms and breathe deeply while tiny particles of salt are dispersed into the surrounding areas, ostensibly easing respiratory conditions. Marketers tout their supposed ability to release negative ions that may enhance physical and emotional health, says Dr. Andy Weil, the founder and program director of the University of Arizona Center for Integrative Medicine. This is based on the idea that air near moving water contains high levels of negative ions, which some researchers have suggested is one reason why spending time in nature has been linked to health benefits. Whether a man-made product can produce the same effect, however, is more dubious. The research. Some data suggests that blasts of positive ions, like those from electronics or hot air, may impair mood and physical health by increasing feelings of stress and anxiety. And some studies show that negative ions in the air may do the opposite and improve people's mood. But this is not a definitive claim. And pink salt lamps have not been shown in studies to generate negative ions anyway. There is no scientific support for such claims related to Himalayan salt lamps, says Weil. Even air purifiers that do generate negative air ions, so-called ionizers, are typically too small to be effective, and experts don't recommend them. The salt lamps may also come with a major unrelated downside. In January, 80,000 pink Himalayan salt lamps were recalled after it was discovered that they could shock people and catch fire. As for the edible salt, some argue that it tastes better than the regular white variety when used in cooking, and that may very well be true for some people. All salts vary somewhat with respect to trace mineral content and texture, says Weil. Proponents claim that pink salt has more minerals than typical salt, but you aren't likely to get any extra health perks from eating it, Weil says. Pink Himalayan salt is nutritionally very similar to regular salt. It's just prettier and more expensive. Salt therapies at spas are also not yet backed by solid evidence. Salt therapy has been used and debated for centuries in medical practice, but it's been more recently used as a complementary or alternative medicine practice, says Dr. Lily Pien, an allergist at Cleveland Clinic. At this time, it has not been definitely studied, and the true benefits are not well known. One possible benefit of the therapy may not come from the salt at all, she says. Giving yourself 30 to 45 minutes of quiet time is a known stress reliever. All right, here's the bottom line. If you want to add a pinch of pink salt to your food, go ahead, but you probably won't reap any special health benefits. There's even less evidence for basking in the glow of a pink Himalayan salt lamp or indulging in a salt-based spa treatment. The most you'll get out of this rock is eye candy, says Weil. Some feel it offers decorative value, he says, but don't expect much else.
Joey Chestnut breaks his own record to win Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest. By Yifen Wang. On Tuesday, Joey Jaws Chestnut devoured 72 hot dogs in 10 minutes to win the annual 4th of July eating contest hosted by Nathan's Famous in Coney Island, New York. Chestnut ate 12 more hot dogs than runner-up Carmen Sincote, retaining his championship title from last year. The number also broke the contest record of 70 dogs in 10 minutes set by Chestnut himself during the 2016 competition. "I'm really happy I got this win," Chestnut said, gripping the mustard belt. "I slowed down way more than I wanted to. I definitely have room for more. I'm looking forward to next year." The professional competitive eater from California had won the well-known contest for 8 years in a row beginning in 2007 until Matt the Megatoad Stoney ended his run in 2015 with a surprise victory. Stoney came in third this year by eating 48 hot dogs. In the women's contest, Miko Sudo came in first place for the fourth straight year, consuming 41 Frankfurters in 10 minutes. Chestnut and Sudo each competed with more than a dozen participants who earned their seats from regional qualifying events. Both champions will leave with a prize of $10,000. Thousands came to watch the contestants scarf down hot dogs and buns on the signature blue and yellow stage, led by an hour-long musical and dance pre-event performance. Many people wore hot dog-shaped foam hats and held signs with messages like "Bun Stuff" to cheer for the eaters.
5 Creative Ways to Photograph Fireworks by Josh Rabb. Shooting fireworks can be tricky. The shots have to be premeditated, and even when successful, they can be difficult to distinguish from other fireworks images. Time selected 5 photographers who use creative approaches to make their images stand out from the rest. Focus pulling fireworks. David Johnson created a slight variation on traditional fireworks images. By focusing the image during the exposure, he creates a tentacle-like effect. To take the image, he recommends the following steps. 1. Prepare. When you hear, see a firework shooting into the air, try as hard as you can to predict where it will explode. 2. Begin the exposure shortly before you predict the explosion. Start out of focus. When the fireworks explode, quickly refocus your lens throughout the explosion until you reach the tack-sharp focal point where the fireworks will be in focus. 4. Once the perfect focus is achieved, end the exposure by releasing the shutter button. Johnson also recommends using a neutral density filter to avoid overexposing the fireworks. He also points out that an f8 aperture will create thin tentacles, while an f2.8 aperture will create thicker ones. The faces of fireworks. Photographer Ed Heaton turned his camera away from the fireworks and instead chose to focus on his young son. "I had just moved to Virginia, and being a single dad is hard, but we try to make the best of every day that we have together," he said. "It turned out that we got the most perfect parking spot to watch the fireworks, and it all came together. I positioned myself right against the side of the truck and took a shot every time I heard a boom. I took the best 12 and made a collage. It's one of my favorite photos." Multiple fireworks in one image. Photographer Chad Graves took a long exposure image of a fireworks show. He left the shutter on the camera open for 15 seconds, allowing the image to fill with fireworks. To avoid overexposing the image, he stood away from light sources on the ground and used a small aperture of f/16, letting very little light into the sensor. Indoor fireworks. We can't condone firing off fireworks inside of buildings, but the results look fantastic. Photographer Masek Jasek shot off fireworks in an abandoned building to illuminate otherwise dark and decrepit spaces. The quirky approach. Not all approaches have to be serious. Noah Kalina, who always has an endearing sense of humor, did short videos of fireworks in the middle of the woods. The result is an intelligent juxtaposition between the wild and the manufactured. North Korea says it's tested an ICBM. Here's why that's a big deal, by Rachel Lewis. North Korea claimed Tuesday to have successfully tested an intercontinental ballistic missile, ICBM, for the first time, a development which, if true, represents a significant advance in the Hermit Kingdom's missile program. State media said North Korea was now a full-fledged nuclear power that has been possessed of the most powerful intercontinental ballistic rocket capable of hitting any part of the world, the BBC reported. The missile landed in the Sea of Japan, and the Japanese government said that the missile launch was a clear violation of UN resolutions as the projectile landed in their exclusive economic zone, reports The Telegraph. South Korean President Moon Jae-in convened a National Security Council meeting following the test and said his military would investigate reports that it was an ICBM. U.S. President Donald Trump tweeted about the test early Tuesday morning. "Does this guy, North Korea leader Kim Jong-un, have anything better to do with his life?" he tweeted. "Hard to believe that South Korea and Japan will put up with this much longer. Perhaps China will put a heavy move on North Korea and end this nonsense once and for all." Here's what to know about ICBMs and why a successful test would be such a big deal. First, what is an ICBM? ICBM stands for Intercontinental Ballistic Missile, a powered and guided projectile able to carry a warhead over 5,600 kilometers through air or space. The key thing that distinguishes it from other missiles is the extraordinary reach, which could allow North Korea to attack targets far beyond its immediate borders. North Korea has had a number of ICBMs under test, according to the U.S. Korea Institute at Johns Hopkins, and the media is widely reporting that the rogue state used a Hwasong-14 in today's exercise. An announcement on North Korea state television said that the projectile flew 933 kilometers after reaching an altitude of 2,802 kilometers, which the Guardian say roughly matches with analysis by South Korea and Japan. The distance led the U.S. to say that the missile was of intermediate range and did not pose a threat to the mainland, the BBC reported. However, the altitude of the test led arms control specialist Jeffrey Lewis to tweet, "That's it. It's an ICBM that can hit Anchorage, Alaska, not San Francisco, but still." Only the U.S., Russia, and China have land-based missiles of this range. The U.K. do have missiles of a similar range in their Trident nuclear program that are submarine-launched. Why is it a big deal? Because it means North Korea could potentially hit the United States. David Wright, co-director of the UCS Global Security Program, says the missile could have the potential to travel 6,700 kilometers. That range would not be enough to reach the lower 48 states or the large islands of Hawaii, Wright wrote, but would allow it to reach all of Alaska. It is North Korea's fourth ballistic missile test since May, when South Korea's Moon Jae-in became president, but would be its first known test of an ICBM. Bloomberg reports that North Korea first began missile testing in 1976 using material from the Soviet Union and has slowly developed the range of its missiles ever since. Experts doubt, however, whether North Korea has the technology to develop a warhead or successfully bring it back into the atmosphere. North Korea first tested nuclear weapons in 2006 and has claimed to have successfully tested a hydrogen bomb in 2016. However, Pentagon spokesman Peter Cook said last year, "The United States has not seen North Korea demonstrate a capability to miniaturize a warhead. We still feel confident that we can deter and respond to a missile threat from North Korea." What defenses does the world have? The Pentagon's Missile Defense Agency has been tasked with developing, testing, and fielding systems to defend the U.S. and its allies against ballistic missiles, and boasts ground, sea, and space-based sensors to detect missiles and ground and sea-based missiles that can intercept enemy projectiles using direct force or explosions. In June, it worked with the Japanese Ministry of Defense to test one of these missiles, the SM-3 Interceptor. However, it failed to intercept its target. Raytheon, the company which produces the SM-3 Interceptor, says it uses sheer force rather than an explosive warhead to destroy its target. But a video posted by the Union of Concerned Scientists back in 2000 doubts that this technology will ever be effective because those who launch the missiles can easily develop technologies to confuse the intercepting missile. Last year, Reuters reported that the U.S. activated an $800 million missile shield in Romania. U.S. Deputy Defense Secretary Robert Work said at the time that the U.S. will continue to defend NATO as long as Iran continues to develop and deploy ballistic missiles. Closer to North Korea, the U.S. has an anti-ballistic missile system in South Korea that can intercept short, medium, and intermediate-range missiles known as THAAD. Bruce Bennett of RAND Corporation told The Atlantic that THAAD only has a range of 200 kilometers, so they can't even really cover Seoul with that battery, let alone something flying out over the Pacific, he added. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.